Oh, hey, hi there. We're going to be looking at a short exchange between Benjamin Boyce and Carl Benjamin. We're sandwiched between the Benjamins here. A segment of about 3 minutes or so, and I have a quick response. Well, maybe not so quick, but I have a relatively succinct response to this exchange that will demonstrate, I think, why the liberal pursuit, as they envision it in this talk, as a kind of secular humanist project of freedom, is ultimately doomed to failure, and why our own existing secular humanist project was doomed to failure. But let's play the segment and I'll explain afterward.
On the plus side, liberalism is a flexible doctrine and has changed many times over the centuries. So I don't see why it can't change again. But the thing is, there are some core assumptions that I detail in the article that are not true, and replacing them does change liberalism into something else, although not something totally alien. The most important ones, though, are for example, the question of equality. Liberalism actually can overcome that. Liberalism really is for freedom, and the idea of freedom is, of course, antithetical to equality. If we're free, then we're different, as Solzhenitsyn puts it, and unless and if we're equal, we're not free.
But
So.
in order to square that with the moral foundations theory of it's not fair. Like that, it's really not fair that some people are smarter than others, that some people are stronger than others. But the replacing fairness with some sort of upgraded Christian love, where we're interdependent, where we our inequality is where we derive value and interdependency, and if we replace that with fairness and equality, we get the state managing every interaction between human beings. Whereas if we have some sort of kind of love, or like some idea that would be derived from Christianity about the divinity in each one of us and that appreciation, humility, that would overcome or balance out that unfairness that the Marxists take advantage of when they try to impose equity.
There is definitely something there, but I fear that we are too far beyond the power of religion to fix this. I don't see most people accepting religious tenets or foundations to any
Well,
kind
but
of ideological
values.
drive.
People are gonna need values. Like, I don't understand.
They are.
I know I was evoking Christianity there, but it's just like there's core concepts in there that are the values.
The problem with liberalism in the term in the is the use of the word equality. They shouldn't have used the word equality.
Right. So he's gonna go into a semantic complaint here. That's sort of a sidetrack from this core piece of exchange between them, and the question of Christianity and Christian values, right? So, just to address one quick thing from Benjamin Boyce first, the problem of fairness, right? Whether any particular inequality is fair or unfair is a question of justice. And justice is about who deserves what, in this context, anyways, right? And so for him to say, or him to sort of parrot the egalitarian complaint that inequalities are unfair, you have to ask, well, unfair according to what standard of just desert, right? If the standard is absolute, then we're talking about something utterly unreasonable, right? In the same way that absolute freedom is a standard that's utterly unreasonable, right? It's something beyond rationality, right? Freedom and equality, even if we are to hold these two items up as fundamental, even diametric fundamentals, right, two opposing camps, you still have to have some sort of bound around them that explains freedom for what, equality of what, right? Try to conceptualize them as unbounded absolutes is incoherent. And I can go into that at another time. But the point here is that he's bandying about this concept of Christian values as if fairness were one of them. But fairness is not. Fairness is a vague conception of justice of desert, right? As Hayek might have put it, or rather Nozick, a justice based on a pattern distribution of goods, right? And so you have to have a pattern that is a standard that says that when things match this pattern, justice has been satisfied, right? That would be a standard of fairness that you could apply specifically, but he doesn't supply one here, just as he doesn't really supply a definition of love, which he offers later, right? That seems to imply that if there were some sort of sentiment that could supplant the resentment that surrounds your typical complaints about fairness, then that sentiment could be a package around which you could cluster a liberal conception of the state. But love, for it to be operative as a tool of social organization in the way that these guys are thinking of it, needs a little bit more, needs to be packaged a little bit better, understood a little bit better. It needs to be more masculine, shall we say. And in particular, if you are looking for a standard of love to replace a standard of fairness, then you could potentially, and I'll explain why this is fraught with all kinds of problems in a moment, but you could potentially replace fairness with the Thomistic conception of love. So the Thomistic conception of love in the Catholic canon is more or less a maxim to will the good of the other, right? When you are willing the good of the other for the good, for the sake of the good, or for the sake of the other, then you are engaging in acts of love, right? So for example, well, actually, let me pause here for a second to say that what really needs to be explained then, if we're going to take this conception of love as willing the good of the other for the sake of the good or for the sake of the other, is what is the good? And this is a huge problem in liberal philosophy. the liberal approach, at least since John Stuart Mill, has been a kind of pluralistic agnosticism with regard to definitions of the good. Because the argument is that the minute the state starts defining what the good is, then you get an interested political body. And what I mean by interested is you get a biased political body. The modern liberal conception is that the state is a kind of indifferent referee between disparate understandings of the good, right? This is the sort of John Rawls view of the state, where every individual gets to define what the good is for himself, and the state is there just to make sure that people don't bump into each other in their varying conceptions of the good, right? This is the utterly relativistic understanding of the good from a political standpoint. But this is a huge problem if you're going to take the Thomistic view of love as willing the good of the other, right? Because if everybody has their own understanding of what the good is, then there can be no consensus about what it would mean to will the good, right? What it would mean to actually act on what the good is for an individual, right? This is a huge problem. But in addition to this, even if they could, the liberals could come to terms on or come to some consensus on an understanding of what the good is, they're limited in what that could possibly be, and yet to remain rational and coherent, right? So, for example, for Aquinas himself, the good was, it was God and God's will as expressed as a creative power, right? It was an act of love in creation itself, right? So Aquinas' theory had a kind of symmetry to it, right? A kind of rational symmetry where the individual will is aligned to the universal divine will, right? And then being aligned to the divine will, the individual acts out that alignment, and in acting it out, he loves himself, he loves the world, and he loves the other he's acting toward, right? So in submitting to the will of God, you are loving others in doing what God wants you to do for others. In the absence of a divine universal will, though, what are your other options? Right? Because that's what the secular version of this would have to be, right? It would have to be some substitute for the divine will, right? That stood in for the will that is defined in willing the good of the other as a definition of love, right? There have actually been attempts at substitution throughout history. One substitution was the Marxist substitution, right? Marx relocated the divine will in the administrative state of his communist theory, right? His idea was that an administrative state would impose its will on the people, and eventually the people would be transformed by this imposition. And their individual wills would be aligned with the socialist eschatology that he had in mind. That at some point, everyone would just act in the right ways, and the state itself would no longer have a reason to exist because it wouldn't have to be there to administer the eschatology. Right? The terrestrial universal will, if you wish, if you want to put it that way. There's another alternative, which is to say there are no universal wills at all, whether terrestrial or divine. There is only the individual will. And where do we... Ow. Where do we see this popping up in political culture today? Well, on the progressive side of the scale, right? Where the unbounded individual will is only free and is only in a state of justice when absolutely nothing defines it, categorizes it, limits it, contains it at all. So the elimination of all categories whatsoever, natural categories, political categories, biological categories, everything gone, right? Which is why you get reactions like Matt Walsh's movie, What is a Woman, right? He's recognizing some of these symptoms and he's bringing them to the fore, right? They want to obliterate the distinction between man and woman. They want to obliterate the distinction between rich and poor. They want to obliterate the distinction between old and young, right? And people who have lived their entire lives within these categories are terrified by that. And I would say rightly so. But the idea here is that in the absence of a universal will, either divine or institutional, terrestrial, then you have a menagerie of absolute individual wills, all just going their own way, an utterly atomistic understanding of human life. The problem with this is that it's out on an extreme edge so far that it's actually turned self-creation into self-destruction, right? Because when you start obliterating categories, even categories necessary to the definition of self, you're obliterating the self, right? So without a self to will, there could be no will, right? In practice, what you end up with, though, is essentially clusters of individual wills in competition with each other for control over other wills. So you get a kind of tribal polity based in the imposition of will anyway, right? It's very, very primitive. So that's no good. So then what do you do, right? Beyond a divine will, beyond a terrestrial universal will, and beyond the menagerie of self-satisfying, self-destructing terrestrial particulars, I'm not sure what sort of substitute is possible that would that would not end in the disaster of atomistic progressivism or materialist authoritarianism, right? But maybe the problem is with the definition of love. Maybe willing the good of the other is not a good enough definition of love. In which case, you have to supply one that makes sense, that isn't just a sentiment, like having a certain kind of affection or feeling for people, right? Because you can't tell people how they should feel about other people, right? But what you can tell them is that to be good people, they have to do good things for other people, right? They have to will the good of the other for the sake of the other, right? So you can command actions of them. That's the whole point of a politics in the first place, and of a theory of practical ethics, right, is to define the actions people should be taking and shouldn't be taking, right? So a definition of love as fundamentally a definition grounded in behavior seems to be far superior to one that's grounded in a definition of psychological states. One, because defining love in terms of a psychological state is multitudinously complex, if not infinitely complex. It's so complex as to be almost indefinable, right? It's not just a simple affection like fear or anger or hunger or lust, right? So what else can you define it in terms of? If you can't really define it in terms of a mere affection, and you don't want to define it in terms of specific behaviors, what other options are there? And this gets me back to what I was saying earlier. We had answers to these questions, and they were grounded in the Christian religion. In the Christian religion, not just secular philosophy. They were grounded in a specific confessional tradition. So, I don't know that it's possible, and we've had, 300-400 years of secular philosophy attempting to do roughly these things all over again from scratch without the aid of a commitment to a belief in God, that have come up with not worse than nothing. They've come up with absolute disasters, right? So it seems to me that if Carl is correct that our society is beyond the influence of its religious tradition, then I think our society is beyond rescue, frankly. Because it's in our religious tradition where you're going to find the answers that Benjamin Boyce was looking for. But who knows? I could be wrong. You decide. And that's really all I had to say about that.